Hi, this is Dr. Laura Downey. I'm here with Dr. Jennifer Lynch, and we are recording our podcast, Inquiring Minds, Mending Tiny Hearts. This episode, we're going to talk about being an early stage investigator in research. And we have Dr. Lynch here. She's currently the Associate Chief of Research for the Division of Cardiothoracic Anesthesiology at Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania, or Philadelphia, sorry. She is an Assistant Professor of Anesthesiology and Critical Care at Perelman School of Medicine. And she also has an appointment in the Department of Bioengineering at the University of Pennsylvania. She obtained her PhD in physics in 2009 from the University of Pennsylvania and focused her doctoral dissertation in the field of biomedical optics. She then went on to medical school at NYU School of Medicine and then did an internship in pediatrics at CHOP, anesthesia residency at UPenn, and then her advanced fellowships in pediatric and pediatric cardiac anesthesia at CHOP. She currently leads a biomedical optics lab at the University of Pennsylvania. And her research is in the field of diffuse optics with a specific focus on the development and use of non-invasive neuromonitoring devices to improve neurodevelopmental outcomes in children with cardiac disease. And thanks for doing this with us today. And I'm interested to hear about your experience.
Well, thank you for that very nice introduction.
So, how did you heard a little bit about it, but how did you end up starting your research career?
Yeah, I think my, as we just said, was a little bit of an atypical path, and I was very much a researcher before I had any interest or thought about becoming a clinician. So I did start after college, went and got my PhD in physics, and my intent was to just continue that path in academia, do a postdoc, and then a faculty position somewhere. And then somewhere along the way, as my research was evolving from basic science research into more translational and clinical studies, that I started entertaining the idea of also becoming a clinician. Actually, met Susan Nicholson during my time as a PhD student, and she was, so inspirational, as she still is today, into that path. And then I went on to med school.
Whoa. So when you were in med school and residency, how did you keep your projects going?
So that it's obviously challenging, as we all know. Med school is busy time, as is the rest of clinical training. I think it was very important to keep things going though, and I'm so glad now that I'm at the stage that I'm at, that I'm glad that I have some productivity over those nine. It was 9 years total. Glad I had productivity during that time. I relied a lot on data I had collected during my PhD, so I had a ton of data that had yet to be analyzed and had or even processed, and papers that I had yet to write. And so that was much easier to manage during medical school. One, because as you said, I went to med school up at NYU, so I was 2 hours away from Philadelphia, where all my work had been. But they had a 3-year MD program, which is what brought me up there. And so being able to do like data processing, data analysis, and paper writing remotely helped. And also, all that work can be done in my own time. So when things weren't quite as busy during med school, and I was on an easier rotation, but again, that was really helpful to when I got to then back to Philadelphia for my clinical training, that I already had things, still going, and that I could pick back up when I was back in Philly.
I think for a lot of us, how do you find the motivation to work on that stuff when you're still studying and trying to go through these rotations and might feel otherwise kind of overwhelmed by medical school or residency?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's a constant struggle. Even now, it's a challenge. I think for me, and probably advice I would give people trying to balance research with clinical work or research in school, is I'm trying to be very goal-oriented. So I try to think about project very like, short-term projects or small goals that I can accomplish. Because I think if I thought about my overarching goal for my research, I would just be so overwhelmed. And it's much easier to think about the 3-hour case I have in front of me instead of, this huge 10-year plan I have. So I really just try to think of very short-term goals, like the paper I want to get out, or even like an abstract for a conference I want to submit, or analysis, like a plot that I want to generate. Just really like concrete goals that I can, more easily meet.
Do you have any advice for people like trying to figure out how to create these blocks of times for writing or analysis? Because I think a lot of people struggle with all of the other things going on.
Yeah, it's very challenging, especially in our medical specialty. It's very, very challenging, but so important, because we could talk about this for hours, which we won't do today, but I think that's why we have less researchers than other specialties, because we just don't have that built into our clinical training during residency. We don't have that built into our jobs now as attendings. And so it's, I've had to be creative, and luckily there's many people that have come before me that have also been creative, and I was able to follow in their footsteps. So a couple of things that I utilized to my advantage. In residency, I went to Penn for my anesthesia residency. They have a Drip Scholars program that I had applied to and was able to get, and that gave me 6 months protected time, and that was spread out over the 3 years of residency, or I think even four years. I think some of it was during my intern year. And so that was really, I'm so glad they had that program, and hopefully other residency programs have something similar, because it really does have to start. If you're going to do this as when you're an attending, you really have to, you really want to start early. You don't have to, obviously you can start at any time, but it really puts us at a disadvantage compared to some of the surgical specialties, for example, when they, usually do 2 years protected research. It helps us to have some research exposure during training. So I did that during residency, during fellowship. I was able to CHOP. I did my fellowship at CHOP. They also had a similar way to structure my time. So I had some protected time during my first year as a peds anesthesia fellow. And then also during my second year as a peds cardiac anesthesia fellow, I had was able to work with my program director to get one day, dedicated day per week, which really set me up well for my transition to my faculty position. Now I still have that same standing day every week. And that's when I do my lab meetings and meet with the rest of my lab. So that was really helpful. So every step of the way, I've kind of just like talked about the people that make my schedule, and just luckily I've been around really supportive people to help me brainstorm ways to make that time structured and consistent.
So I guess there are two things about that. One, I was looking at your kind of background, you luckily probably got a lot of statistical kind of training, or at least education, as well as like how to design projects. For people who are coming with outgoing through a PhD program, how do you recommend people try to get that experience or kind of start that? Because I think we're seeing more and more people who are MD straight and trying to just do research.
I think it depends on what your goal is going to be for how you're going to do your research. Like, you're right. For me, during my PhD, so I learned this is also different from every PhD program is different. So I did a PhD in the School of Arts and Sciences because it was in physics. And so I had to first get a master's, which was, kind of included in that whole time. But the first 2 years was master's, and it was a lot of course taking. And then I did my PhD part, which was the research part. The courses I took for my master's, I did, thankfully did a lot of biostat courses. So I did a lot of statistical training during my master's. So now I think it's a good idea, is if they want that same level of training, going back to get a master's degree, even now as attendings. And so at least at Penn and CHOP, we have a lot of pathways to do that and a lot of support if you want to go get a master's degree. We also, at least our institution, we have statisticians on staff that you can use grant money to support, or maybe you have department funds that can support to help with projects. So if you don't necessarily need that training for yourself, but you just need to outsource that work for a certain project, using the stat support at your institution. And obviously there's other resources too, if you can like self-teach, but I do think it's better to have like that, if you really want to learn how to do it well, to have that official training through a course or a degree program.
Yeah, and I do feel like some of the statistical things that are being done in clinical research have become much more complex and not just straight comparison tests. So,
well, even I outsource some stuff, because I definitely don't have a PhD in statistics, and I definitely need that level of expertise sometimes. But I'm very grateful that I have some basic understanding. Of some very basic, simple stats tests. And it also helps when I now have to review papers or review grants to just have some baseline understanding.
And I would say for people who are looking at this, reviewing papers is a great way to see when statistics are done well or not done well, when you read the feedback that's given.
Yes.
The other thing I would mention, people who are looking at doing starting out, especially if you have retrospective studies and you need help, but sometimes there are people we have the public health school, and there are often people who are looking for projects for the semester. And so they may be able to help do some of the statistics for some of the initial pilot studies if you don't have funding to get
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Help. So how did you kind of approach your negotiation pack or your startup package when you were starting as an attending?
Well, like I said earlier, there isn't a lot of framework for this in anesthesia. So I first started out by talking to some of my colleagues in the School of Arts and Sciences at Penn, in the engineering school at Penn. I do have some other physician scientist colleagues, but they're in the Department of Pediatrics at CHOP. They're not in anesthesia. So I asked them to send me their startup packages. So I looked at those. And in my mind, when I went to negotiate my startup package, I thought it should be very similar to the other physician scientists at CHOP, even though historically we don't do that in the Department of Anesthesiology and Critical Care. It is a very different department. But that was my goal, and I'm very grateful that the department leadership at the time was very supportive of that, and having somebody that had a similar startup package to what my peers were getting in the Department of Pediatrics. So that's how I framed it. And I also reached out and got advice from people who were doing research in my department who were like mid-career or later on in their career, and asked them what they thought would be good in the anesthesia framework. But a lot of what I asked for was modeled off of people in the Department of Pediatrics.
Well, I think for people who are just starting to look at this, I think you forget that you need that protected time and make sure it is truly protected, as well as funding for equipment and personnel. I think a lot of us think we can do it all, but research is so much about a team. And so building that team that can be successful is really important.
Yeah, I think especially given the clinical demands of our job, like we really have to ask for a lot, because it's just going to be even more challenging for us to succeed at this versus someone where that's just a little bit more inherently built into their job description.
Yeah. As others might be looking at this or even negotiating maybe a mid-career job switch, what would you recommend they prioritize when they're either interviewing or negotiating?
I mean, numbers one through five is your time. So like how much protected time you're going to have, how that time is going to be protected, being very explicit about that protected time. Because we all know anesthesia time, it can mean anything, right? It can mean days of the week that you're working. It can mean how long, if it's more of a shift model, how long your shift is, how much call you're taking. Like you really have to spell it out. Like, what is this going to look like? Like if I said I want to work clinically only 4 days a week and be non-clinical 1 day a week, but then those four clinical days are 16-hour days, that's very, it's going to be very different than if they're 8-hour days. So just really spelling it out exactly how your clinical and non-clinical work is going to look like. And then I think you need to think about what kind of research you're going to do. For me, I needed certain things. I definitely needed startup funds. I do translational research with optical neuromonitoring devices. So I needed optical tools. I needed the stuff to build the device. I needed funding for staff, so either a graduate student, which I do have now, or a research assistant to help run the clinical studies that I do, and then a lab space to be able, can't have a student and then tell them just to, work from home every day. So have it in place for the student to work and to build the instrument. So I needed specific things, but it just depends on what kind of work, what else you're going to need. But everyone needs time, so that should be the first thing that you figure out.
And question about that. I know there are different models at different institutions. With your institution, or kind of thinking what would be best, in some places there's a salary difference between academic versus clinical only staff. Have you run into that? Do you kind of see that as a benefit?
So
that's it.
I mean, I'm not sure if this is what you're asking. I mean, adjacent to this question is the idea of how you're going to fund your protected time. I've only worked at one place so far. Lucky that I have had to move around much yet. Everyone's the same employee under the same umbrella. So and that's not a difference in terms of like what the salary that you're earning, but if for research grant purposes, like if you're funding your time from a research grant and say, I'm going to get a grant for a project, and then for this project, I need 10% of my time for this project. Well, if that grant comes from the NIH, they're not going to fund 10% of my time at my salary level.
Right.
And that's going to be true pretty much for every anesthesiologist. So they have a salary cap that is lower than most clinical physicians. So then you need to figure that out with your department, what that means in terms of your time. Do you need to not apply, but do you need to apply for grants other than NIH? And there are other mechanisms out there that are not the NIH. So for example, I also apply for DOD grants. So they have a call out for certain mechanisms. The one that I am applying to is once a year they have a call out and they have different topics that they are interested in. And fortunately, this year and last year, they congenital heart disease was a topic that the DOD was interested in funding projects for. And they don't have a salary cap. So if I do a project that the DOD is going to fund and I say I need 10% of my time protected to work on this project, the DOD will support 10% at my salary level. And there's other foundation grants, those usually aren't as big of a mechanism, but there's other mechanisms out there that don't have that salary cap. But the NIH notoriously has a salary cap. And so that needs to be discussed with your institution, what's going to happen if a grant, because they have to sign off when your department chair will sign off when you apply for a grant saying, we will give the time that she is saying she needs for this project, but that they're not going to get the money for that time. So that needs to be a discussion.
I think that's a very important thing, especially in anesthesia and procedural specialties in general.
Yes.
So talking about some of those NIH grants, there's some early training grants and early funding. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So what everyone should know is this thing called an ESI bump for NIH grants. So that's ESI stands for Early Stage Investigator, which you are when you're within 10 years of finishing your last clinical training. So for me, that was my last clinical training was pediatric cardiac anesthesia, which I finished in the summer of 2023. So until the summer of 2033, I will be an early stage investigator unless I get an R01 level grant or an equivalent. So for example, some of these DOD mechanisms will be an equivalent of an R01 level grant. So as soon as I get one of these, I am no longer eligible to have this status. Why this status is important is because you get a substantial bump in terms of your pay line. So when you apply for NIH grant, you apply at different institutions. So I usually apply into NHLBI, so the National Heart Lung, wait, NHL, whatever it stands for, Heart and Lung Institute, something like that. And then, so this past couple years, the pay line has been 14%. So you have to score in the top 14% of the grants in order for your grant to get funded. But unless you're an ESI. If you're an ESI, then you get a 10% bump on top of that. So instead of being in the top 14%, I have to be in the top 24%, which is a huge difference. So it's a really good tool that the NIH has to help encourage early stage investigators. And it makes sense because once you have a lab and you have funding, it's much easier to get the preliminary data and to get more grants out there. So it's a necessary bump and something that definitely should be utilized while you're in that. Something to think about if you want to be a funded researcher and you're still within that 10-year window.
Awesome. What about some of these training grants that are available? People hear about T32s or K grants. What are kind of the differences or preferences to go for those versus an R grant?
Yeah, so it depends what you're trying to find. So I was on a T32 during my pre-doctoral study years. So I have not been on a T32 since some I have not been on a postdoctoral T32, but I have thought about whether or not to do a K or an R. So a K and a T32, these are training grants. So you're going to be mentored by someone. And you're going to be working on a project that you and that person come up with together. And the point of these is to train you to do something so that you can become an independent investigator. So I had to make that decision when I first finished clinical training, should I go for a K award or an R award? And the goals would have been different. So a K award really just funds your time. So the point of it is to protect your time so that you have time to build and start your research career. Notoriously, traditionally, K awards fund set give you protect time of 75%. There are some clinical specialties that they list, the NIH lists, that they'll let you do it with 50%. These are specialties that have like procedural specialties that you would lose your skills if you did that work less than 50% of the time. Pediatric cardiac anesthesia is not listed on the NIH website, but I have a feeling that like we could make the case that if you're applying for a K award from our specialty, that you should be in that 50% group, not the 75% group. But again, you're not getting much funding for the project, you're getting funding for your time. And then you would then be working underneath a mentor to learn a skill, learn how to do independent research. And then the next step beyond that would be then you would be proposing an idea for your first independent project and you would be applying for an R. I made the decision instead of doing that to apply for an R from the start because where I was with my project, I really wanted to fund the project. I was fortunate that I have a startup package. I had some protected time already, but what I didn't have was like funding to keep to maintain a lab. And so I'm really hoping to secure that so that I can keep the grad students, the research assistants, and keep the lab functioning, which to me is more important than my personal time. I feel like having that PhD and having those courses that I've already taken was a good part of my training to become an independent investigator. Versus if you don't have that background, then a K award might be a good opportunity to get some of that research training.
So kind of one thing for somebody like me who is an MD only, maybe a K award early on would have been kind of helpful in getting that time to be able to build those skills.
And it is a more traditional route to take for a lot of physician scientists because like we said, it's hard to get the research training during clinical training. So typically then someone would get a K award and then have that time to get the research training and then move on to an R. Although I'm definitely not the first person or the last person to jump right to an R, but it just depends on your own situation, what makes more sense.
And I used a lot of the pilot grants or foundation grants or society stuff for my early things. Yeah. Well, since it sounds like you're applying for an R, what are some of the common pitfalls that you've discovered for your first submissions?
Oh, I think what everyone says when they are asked this question, because I've asked, when I'm conducting these interviews and I ask these people the questions, everyone says, well, don't get discouraged when you don't get one funded. And I'm definitely falling in that pitfall right now. So it is really easy to get discouraged because these grants take a long time, like months of work to put these grants in. And when you think it's like the best thing you've ever produced, and then for it to come back and not be funded is devastating and very discouraging. And so I'm trying to just follow the advice that was given to me of just this is part of the process. Just stay persistent and just keep putting them in, and then it'll happen. But it is very hard to like have that doubt, like, well, can I just not do this? Is it just not going to happen? But trying to stay positive. In the meantime, like you said, I'm glad you mentioned foundation grants and other grants. I think that's a great resource for people to keep in mind because I'm working towards these R's, like, knowing that I can keep putting in for those grants too, to keep funding coming in as, working toward a bigger grant is important.
Yeah. And I think someone gave me the advice that only about 1 in 10 grants actually get funded. And so recognizing that it's not a personal thing, but that there's just a limited amount of money and things get chosen for a variety of different reasons it's important to remember, even though it can be really hard when you're going through it.
Yes.
What about trying to balance running a lab while you're also becoming a new attending?
Yeah, that's very hard. I can't say I have an answer. I don't know if I'm doing it well or not, but it's challenging. I think the best advice I can say, I don't know if this is doable for everyone, but the best thing I did was I'm so grateful it worked out and grateful that my division supported me is I was able to structure my schedule so that I have a consistent day of the week. So it's Tuesdays for me, and every Tuesday I'm non-clinical. And that has been such a huge help in trying to maintain this balance between clinical and non-clinical work, because now I have a day I can tell my grad students I am available every single Tuesday. So you may not hear from me Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, and I may be impossible to reach, but Tuesdays I am yours. So like that was so helpful. I'm so glad that worked out. But yeah, because otherwise, it comes down to setting boundaries and I have to be there for my students sometimes 100%. And obviously when I'm with a patient, I'm with that patient 100%. So just finding ways to do that. So you can give both things your all, which is, very challenging.
And I'm sure having that set day a week allows you to plan things much further in advance, lab meetings and that kind of thing that you would normally do on a regular basis.
Yes.
I know one of the things I struggled when I was managing people and trying to manage the OR is learning to manage a team and students and get projects continually moving. How have you found that, and what have you found works or doesn't work?
I'm still learning every day. I think kind of like what I was saying before, my strategy in med school and clinical training was to set short-term goals for myself. I'm finding that to be a useful strategy in managing people now as I try to set short-term goals for them. And so, you know, half of our lab meeting every week is we just sit down and we talk about the goals we set last week and what are our new goals for next week. And I think that's definitely a sign of like an early PI. That's just, I think as I get more senior, as like I've seen more senior PIs, I think they're probably more hands-off, but for now I'm like very hands-on, very concrete about my expectations, and we set really concrete goals. It's just so we can all kind of stay on path, and I think that'll evolve over the years, but for now that's working, working pretty well with the stage that I'm at and the stage that my students are at.
That's great. So just thinking about future physician scientists, what would you say some of the biggest challenges you've faced and kind of how to deal with them?
I would say the biggest challenges are just balancing. I mean, I think the biggest challenges are that this is very hard to do with our specialty. We have a very hard clinical specialty. It's very clinically demanding. We don't go into the specialty if we want to do this part time. We love, you know, obviously you wouldn't choose a specialty like this. So to do a specialty like this and give it your all, like we all want to do, and then also have a productive research career is challenging. And I'm still trying to figure it out. I think the things that I already mentioned are the things that have worked well so far. So like finding ways to have strict boundaries between the two. So a dedicated day per week, staying consistent with short-term goals. So I was never the most organized student ever in my life. I've never had a to-do list until the past 2 years. And now I have a to-do list that I update, you know, every day. I check things off, and it's like the only way that I'm able to keep things moving at the rate that I'm happy with them moving at. So yeah, short-term goals, keeping boundaries, a standard day of the week that I have for non-clinical work. Those have been the things that have kept this somewhat in an okay spot.
Now, I think you've been in attending for about 2 years and trying to manage this lab. I don't know if you're feeling burnout, but have you found any ways to try to avoid getting burned out from basically having two full-time jobs and then, of course, your mom, wife, yes, too. So, you know.
I mean, definitely comes in waves, the feeling of burnout. I think reflecting on the positives is whenever I can, celebrating the successes. I think focusing more on like getting my students what they need and making sure that they're happy and successful. Same with my patients. Like when I get a patient through a tough case, that really helps my burnout. So just focusing on the positives and like reminding myself like what my goal is every day. It's very easy to dwell on all this to granted and can find it. I just wasted 3 months of my life writing it. It's easy to dwell on that, but instead of that, I'm saying, well, you know, my student just got this like best oral abstract award. Like that's great for her. And like this patient just got to this really tough case. That was a great day. And so just focusing on the little wins.
Yep. I think one thing you and I've also talked about is it's hard to do, but saying yes selectively to things that will keep you moving in the direction you want to.
Yes. I'm trying to do that. Remind myself that every day that I need to get better about that, but yes, working on that.
It's very hard when you're new attending. You feel like you should need to say yes to every opportunity. Otherwise you won't get any more. But I think as we've talked about, sometimes that leads to having too many things going on that you can't focus and finish the things that you need to.
Yes, very true.
One thing that always comes up, whether it's being a clinician or a researcher or an educator, is how to find mentors. Do you have any advice for listeners?
I think you're never going to have just one mentor. I think you just need to surround yourself with people that can help you with different aspects of your life and career. So, for example, my research mentor is Todd Kilbaugh. He has a research career that a very impressive research career that I strive towards. So he's a great mentor for me because one, to me, that is what I'm trying to achieve. And he also has a very similar communication style to mine. So that, I think that's really important when you have a mentor, someone that you can talk to easily, and someone who understands, has been through what you've gone through and understands sort of where you are. But I don't go to him mostly for like, you know, for certain questions, so stuff about my research career, my career trajectory, my academic promotion process, stuff like that. Susan Nicholson is my clinical mentor, so I go to her when I have clinical questions or a case that comes up that I want her input on. So And I have a group of people that I go to for different reasons. And I think that is like what most people really need is just a variety of people that they can go to.
That's amazing. Well, we're almost finished, but just would you like to leave any of our residents or fellows with a piece of advice or even junior faculty?
Yes, I would say we as anesthesiologists can be physician scientists too, just like every other medical physician out there. Although it's not as common, I think we're all doing the work to make that this more prevalent, and just keep doing it. We spent this whole last 30 minutes of this conversation talking about different ways you can achieve this, and hopefully more people come and think of more even more creative ways how they can add research into their anesthesia career. So just keep doing it because we can be physician scientists too.
Well, thank you so much, and we will see you guys next time.